you know, this was out in the 1880s with William Banting.
Yeah.
And then we spoke about this with epilepsy in the early 20th century. And then we spoke about this in the 70s and 80s with Atkins. And now we're speaking about it again. This will not go away.
Yeah.
Because this works.
Welcome to the Flippin' Health Podcast, where we turn medicine on its head, flip it upside down, shake it all about, and see what comes out. We're going to challenge convention and change medicine for the better.
Hello, I'm Grant Schofield.
And I'm George Henderson.
Welcome to the
Flippin' Health Podcast.
Grant Schofield here with Rob. Rob, tell us a bit of yourself. Who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, g'day, Grant. Hi. Rob Zabo. I'm a GP in Melbourne. I started the clinic with a low-carb clinic about nearly 4 years ago now. We see lots of patients who are looking to reverse insulin resistance with a variety of diseases, whether it's weight, type 2 diabetes, even managing type 1 diabetes, and just see a lot of patients helping them to adopt a low-carbohydrate diet to help their health.
So most people would be surprised that those clinics are popping up, and then they've been... Did it surprise you that you did one?
Well, I certainly didn't see it coming, you know, a couple of years prior to that. It's just that I sort of, through my own health journey, ended up in this area where, with my own diagnosis of type 2 diabetes some 7 years ago now, it sort of led me, after about a year, down the journey of starting a low-carb diet myself, and just saw the power that had in reversing the disease and giving me this health and vitality that I didn't think was going to be possible. And kind of couldn't ignore that, you know, once I'd experienced it myself, and then started to cautiously implement it with some patients, and they had the same similar sorts of results. Many people have said, once you see these things, you can't unsee them. And so, I just began to realise just how powerful this stuff is. So, you know, after I'd kind of, you know, gone through a lot of my own practice patients, spoken to them about this, and I sort of thought, I need to scale this in some way, because I feel like I've had the reach that I can have in my own practice. And that was how the low carb clinic was born.
So how do you operate? You're not bulk billing with Medicare and
SM? No, it's a private clinic. So we work with a dietitian. So I've got Camilla Dahl is a dietitian that I work with, and she's just awesome. What we do is see patients initially together, and for the first half an hour of the consultation, it's basically me running the consultation, finding out what their goals are, and all their past history, with Camilla there as well.
Yeah.
And Camilla contributes a bit during that consultation
as well. That's cool.
So, you know, she is privy to all of the nuance that goes with them telling their own story, and, you know, the journey as to how they got to be here and what they want to achieve, so that then she takes them next door into her room for the second part of the consultation and continues on with the food aspect. So it's really nice, because the person dealing with the food is the person most qualified dealing with the food, not me.
Yeah. But the guy who's dealing with the meds and all the other comorbidities and things
correct.
Going on is you.
Correct. Yeah. So it's really nice that way. It's really having Camilla there for that whole medical consultation, I think, helps her to see the context. That means the patient doesn't have to repeat themselves. Yeah. So it actually, works quite well.
And how does it work with you getting referrals from other GPs, and what's been the response from the community?
Yeah, look, it's been interesting. There's been such a variety of ways in which people come to see us, whether it's them looking this up themselves online and finding us online and coming off their own bat, or some specialists are referring to us. You know, we've got a rheumatologist, Daniel Lewis, who refers quite a few patients with fibromyalgia. He's a kind of Melbourne's fibromyalgia chronic fatigue syndrome guru.
Yeah, right.
And we've had amazing results with people with fibro having the pain reversed, and chronic fatigue having their energy return.
Cool.
By doing a ketogenic diet, often quite quickly.
Yeah.
So then there's orthopaedic surgeons.
They will send them in a sort of prehabilitation situation? Is that how they do it?
Depending. Either trying to prevent surgery. So we've actually got some really visionary surgeons that are trying to talk themselves out of, or, you know, what, practice their way out of surgery, which is, you know, pretty kudos to them.
Yeah.
Or even preoperatively, for people just to lose weight to maximise the chances of having a successful surgery.
Okay, cool. And the system's changing a bit around diet, weight, the prevention of disease and healthy lifestyles. And how are you seeing that in Melbourne and Australia? And the system, people still talk about us having a sickness system, not a health system. Have we made progress? And what do we still need to do?
Look, there is, and it comes through as I talked about the power of this way of eating and of doing, you know, combining it. Diet's not the only thing that we need to look at when it comes to health. There's pillars of health and the sleep and managing enjoyment, finding aspects of life that are fulfilling and enjoyable, I think is also critical to well-being. And so I think when people can combine those things, and actually low carb is amazing because it gives people this mental clarity, which then facilitates those other aspects of life, I think. And you can plan because you have this mental energy and mental clarity. So I think when people see their friends and families experiencing this change, that's what is probably driving. It's not the top, it's the bottom up.
Yeah. But do you have any bitterness against the system in the sense that, you know, you've had to set up a private clinic, you're relying on out-of-pocket expenses, and in fact you feel like, presumably you feel like you're doing one of the more important jobs in medicine.
I must admit, it has crossed my mind that I feel a bit cheated in my education. Yeah. You know, a lot of the things that I've learnt are the most powerful. I've kind of had to stumble across.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
This is the stuff that should be in our lectures as medical students, because this is the stuff that is the critical, you know, life and death stuff. That things like, you know, if you want to reverse your type 2 diabetes, if it's quite severe, you need to do a lot of fasting. You know, you need to probably have really infrequent meals. And if you have low carb, 3 meals a day with snacks, it's not going
to
reverse.
Right, because you need to deplete liver glycogen and get a basic reset. Is that an easy way to...
The longer you fast for, the deeper into repair, the more accelerated that repair becomes, you know. And so eating twice a day for somebody who's got severe diabetes probably isn't enough fasting. You know, I've had one man that just keeps on popping into my head is a guy that ate... He came to me, so I don't think I'm an ogre. But he said, for the last 3 months, I've been eating once every 48 hours for 3 months.
Yeah.
And he'd gone from 3 pills... for diabetes down to non-diabetic off medication in 3 months.
Yeah.
And it just kind of shows to showed me, I mean, this is the stuff that I'm saying, you know, I should have been taught.
Yeah.
But he taught me that when you fast, that the fast gets more and more rapid in the repair as the longer you're going.
Right.
And if you can get a big chunk of repair, because as soon as you eat, repair stops.
Yeah, because you get anabolic again.
Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the bricks arriving, you know, at the front of the house means you need to keep on building the extension, right? Because there's going to be more bricks arriving. You need to get rid of them.
Yeah,
whereas when they don't arrive, then that gives you kind of a chance to a spring clean. You can start doing some repairs around the house, you know. But as soon as the next lot of bricks arrive, the repair stops.
Yeah.
And you need to go back into building.
Yeah, right. Great analogy. So just on that, I think, I don't know if you just went to a talk I was facilitating with a bunch of docs, and one of them remarked that basically she got her nutrition information by going to a talk that someone gave at her daughter's school. that was her source of changing her mind medically about it.
But there are more people talking about this, you know, in non-academic circles, and that's where this is happening. But because, you know, this was out in the 1880s with William Banting, and then we spoke about this with epilepsy in the early 20th century, and then we spoke about this in the 70s and 80s with Atkins, and now we're speaking about it again. This will not go away.
Yeah.
Because this works, and this will stay. This will keep on coming back, and I feel as though this is now established itself as a part of our culture.
So thinking about yourself and then beyond into medicine, what's the best possible future look like in 10 years? What are we going to be doing in medicine? What would have changed?
Well, we've now, you know, in April of this year, we saw the American Diabetic Association start to acknowledge that low carbohydrate diets actually have quite a
profound effect
on improving diabetes and on type 2 diabetes and reducing medication requirement and are safe. And that's radical. And I think that and they also commented that there's quite a bit of evidence. Yeah. It's interesting that it took this point for them to say that, because that evidence was there last year too.
Yeah, and the year before.
And there was no mention of there being any evidence, and suddenly there's mention of there being quite solid evidence. We knew that there was solid evidence, it's just that it hasn't actually... But, you know, good on them for now saying that. So this can't be ignored forever. And I think that there's going to be more and more... The fact that there are more and more people that are talking about this to their doctors and to their diabetic educators is meaning that there will be more discussion, which is going to mean more officialdom having comment on it.
Yeah. At what point will we change the health budget to invest more heavily in this type of thing? Of the 80 odd to 100 billion dollars that gets spent in Australia on health, what's it going to take to reallocate some of that?
The driving force there is people wanting to feel well.
Yeah.
You got to remember that obviously the counter force is profit.
Yeah.
So.
And people also don't want to be sick when they are sick.
Yeah. And so if they can notice their friends and their family starting to actually feel well and start to engage with life and feel good, that is a real driving force. That, you know, this is where politics originates from. You know, I think that politics has its origins in people wanting to better their own society.
Yeah.
Politics' origin isn't in profit driving for corporations. This is a new radical development in where...
Yeah, good point. That is the point of public office, really, is to change society for the better.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, early on, back in, you know, ancient Greece, there was people that could see themselves profiteering from, you know, decisions in politics. But this magnification of this profiteering from politics and policy is a pretty exaggerated version of that. And so that is really sort of a modern era situation. And the basis is people's well-being. So I think as we get sicker and sicker, you know, often it takes, like for me, it took me being sick with my diagnosis of type 2 diabetes to get here.
Is it embarrassing when do you feel like ashamed about that when it's happening? You're trained in medicine, you've been to medical school, you're in general practice.
Well, I was...
And you're presumably not just walking around hoovering down Coca-Colas and eating... licorice all sorts.
Hey, I had a lot of sugar in my life.
Yeah.
A hell of a lot of sugar. I was raised on sugar. You know, my mum's sort of quite, you know, sorry about that. I had no idea. And in fact, I remember someone telling patients that sugar was fine as long as you weren't diabetic.
Oh, you've said that?
Oh, absolutely. That's what I was taught. I remember being taught that.
Yeah.
So, it's... I was ashamed, yes, when I was diagnosed. Mm. And I kept it to myself because it was like a, you know, like in inverted commas, you know, fat man diabetes, you know, and I was about 10 or 15 kilos heavier than I am now, so yeah, I wasn't obese at all.
No.
But I still felt like I'd done something wrong, you know, and, you know, it's obviously, that's how it's taught to us, that there's a mistake that you've made in your lifestyle in some way. So I didn't know what that mistake was. At that time, I didn't actually recognise that the sugar in my life had been the cause. Yeah. But now, obviously, in reflection, I can recognise that.
Yeah. So you're also an environmentalist, which I think people will find interesting. And you're a well-educated environmentalist. I've heard you talk passionately about that. And there's a lot of discussion about our food supply and what the solutions are. We've got environmental problems in on the planet. What goes there?
Well, for me, it's all one and the same, because whether it's, you know, looking after, you know, the insides of your organisms or looking after the planetary organism, I think it's all pretty much connected. I don't see there being a difference. And so, you know, I think that, you know, we just describe ourselves as being discrete, you know, entities, like you're a man, I'm a man, but we are, you know, our skin's permeable. And so we are actually part of one, and the globe is, you know, I think, you know, this kind of creature. So for me, they're very similar. And the big issue, obviously, of our time is this climate situation. That this is the thing that we hear about a lot, and where the where that's coming from. And the big kind of gripe that I have is that the role of animals in carbon sequestration, particularly the role of ruminants, of cows, of sheep, in resulting in soil buildup and soil growth, i.e. carbon sequestration, is not being spoken about nearly enough.
There's a lot of anti-beef and meat and farming.
And this is bizarre, because before anthropogenic climate change, so before the Industrial Revolution, we had more ruminants, far, far more ruminants than we have today, all making their own methane.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a climate emergency.
Yeah.
And we need to ask the question why, despite all that methane, we didn't have a climate emergency. You know, and I guess the conclusion that I can only come to is it's not the methane.
Yeah.
And what those animals were doing is fascinating, because now when you take animals off, like, for example, if you take in the US and around the world, in Africa, various places, animals have been taken off national parks because they've been assumed to be trampling the earth and destroying the earth and causing deserts. What actually happens
actually
is...
You get the exact opposite effect. You accelerate
desertification.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing
and
is...
why is that?
Yeah, so what happens is grasses in those areas, you have long periods of an arid period. So you have dry periods of the year. Only maybe 3 months of the year there might be moisture.
Yeah.
And unlike other areas where there's moisture all year round. So, for example, in England, there's moisture all year round. Mm-hmm. So in England...
Or New Zealand, frankly.
In New Zealand, there's moisture all year round. So grass doesn't actually dry out. Yeah. And what happens is that it composts in a moist environment and it rots naturally.
Yeah.
But in most of the world, that doesn't happen because in most of the world, you have prolonged dry periods. And if the grass doesn't actually compost, if it dries out, what happens is that it oxidizes and it becomes this hard, tough, sort of grey and then black, long grass. That blocks sunlight. And because it either compresses or it stays standing upright, it blocks the sun and it doesn't allow new grass to grow. And it doesn't compensate.
It's not taking any carbon in either. It's not dealing with.
Well, when the grass doesn't grow, then you're not actually pulling carbon out of the air. You've got to remember that grass, blades of grass, are photovoltaic cells.
Yeah.
You know, and they actually not just produce energy, and they produce sugar.
Yeah.
Out of sunlight and carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
So they're actually taking carbon dioxide out of this. So the way that you actually need to get those blades of grass that are at the soil level to grow is to provide them with sunlight, and you need to actually get rid of that dead grass.
Oh, so you're saying it's animals will come through and herding animals will come through and trample it down.
Enter ruminants.
Yeah.
Right. Ruminants work in a pack predator herd effect, and what happens is they eat out quite a bit of that grass that would have otherwise been left there to oxidize and block the sunlight. They eat that grass out. They dump manure, dump urine, and then they move on because they don't want to be eating over their own manure.
Yeah.
So they actually move on quite quickly. This is in nature I'm talking about. Yeah. This is what was happening before the Industrial Revolution because we had, you know,
so
vast,
like bison on the North African range.
Right,
or
buffalo, antelope in Africa, you know, the springbok, you name it, right? And they would be in a very tight pack because of the predators that were surrounding them and to keep themselves safe. And they would always be in a tight pack but always moving. And that patch of grass where they'd, you know, eaten the grass out and dumped all their manure and urine wouldn't go back to for, you know, many months, maybe 3, 6, 12 months. And in that time that grass just goes berserk.
And goes green and the whole thing.
Far from damaging the grasslands, what these beasts are doing is fertilizing the grasslands.
Enriching the soil.
Right. You know, and then you're providing them the sunlight and the moisture for the grass just to go berserk.
Yeah.
So they're actually fertilising the... And this is how the grass plains, which have got massive amounts of carbon because of really deep soils... and you remember the deeper the soil, the more carbon sequestration you've got. In Australia, we have gone from, on average, prior to European settlement, about 10% carbon content in our soils.
Yeah.
So down to about 1%.
Wow, is that right?
On average.
Yeah.
So we've... You know, we have this concept of what Australia looks like, and when we drive around, you know, the countryside of it being kind of, you know, bald green patches. Yeah. It didn't look like that. It was lush.
Yeah, right.
There were creeks flowing everywhere because the soil held the moisture. The soil was deep. It held the moisture. It slowly released the moisture into little creek beds so that the creeks were permanent all year round phenomena. And it was in a place of abundance. And we know this from the diaries of the early settlers in the 1830s.
Yeah.
They described nothing like we see today.
Right. And in the meantime, it's become desert.
So we've lost 90% of our soil carbon. We've gone from about 10% to about 1% carbon content in our soils.
Yeah.
So that carbon's in the air.
Yeah, right.
So the thing is that the carbon that we're talking about in terms of this... climate change is not just fossil fuel burning.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, there's been some people have made calculations and I don't know how accurate, but that quite possibly if we were to stop all fossil fuel burning today, we possibly wouldn't stop a climate emergency because of the fact that we're accelerating in our erosion of soil.
Right, and plant monocropping isn't going to sort that.
Right, and so all these people who are so well intentioned with their vegan diet to, you know, thinking that they're going to be saving the planet and that they're moving away from meat because that's environmentally sound, for all the right reasons, are accelerating climate change through leading from leading to the erosion of soil. Which, of course, when you erode soil, you think, well, that just, you know, is bad because we can't plant plants. No, that soil's now that carbon's now in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and you can't get it back very easily.
It's difficult. The best way you can get it back is by utilizing ruminants.
Yeah, so they're part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Right,
yeah.
Right, and this is the bizarre irony we're talking about. We're demonizing something which is actually the solution. Now, I'm not saying that the way that we're actually farming beef at the moment is the best. It's not, because it doesn't
mimic
nature.
And especially in some parts of the world with feedlots and concrete and...
Oh, awful, yeah. Awful stuff. And so the amount of water and the amount of grain and soil erosion that you get from planting corn and soy to feed cattle is awful, yeah. Let alone the cruelty of you know, treating
yeah.
animals that way.
Yeah.
And them living in their own manure,
yeah.
which is awful
yeah.
in itself.
Yeah.
But you can actually stock more and more cattle on land that you regenerate.
Yeah.
The thing is, we're all talking about sustainability, and sustainability is not enough. We can't sustain an absolutely destroyed ecosystem. That's not enough.
No, we need to
regenerate. Yeah. We need to renew our ecosystems, and this is what cattle can do for us.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and there's some really, really cool stuff that's developed in the last 40 years in terms of regenerative agriculture techniques that work. Like, this stuff's proven. I kind of feel like this is the keto of planetary health.
Yeah, right. But it's an important thing to be literal with, right?
How do you mean?
Well, just, I mean, because I get this all the time, and I'm not literate like you are with this
yeah.
this side of things. So people are going, what about the meat and the animals and the planet? And I'm just like,
Yeah. And I was the same about a year ago. And so the thing is, I just can't stop myself reading now. I find it so fascinating.
Yeah,
it's
fascinating.
It's kind of where I was, about 5-6 years ago with reading about locale, because
yeah.
I just couldn't stop at that stage too.
Yeah.
But it is, but the most fascinating part of it is the parallels that I find with low carbon keto, yeah. because... You know what I was talking about with fasting and how the body regenerates.
Yeah.
You know, you reverse type 2 diet.
Yeah.
Your body
wants the exact opposite of what you'd think of, right? At first,
correct.
When you first
correct.
Think of it, it's like, I'm not eating anything. I'm just going to be starving.
Correct.
Yeah.
But actually, what's happening is repair.
Yeah.
And this is the interesting thing, is that your body is doing that, and it's doing that because it wants to move in that direction.
Yeah.
Our bodies actually move towards a state of health.
Yeah.
They don't move towards a state of disease.
Yeah.
Given the right environment, given the right circumstances. I don't go into my patient's pancreas and make it secrete more insulin. I don't
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
It does it itself.
Yeah. Well, and the planet is the same thing.
Correct.
As it's an
correct.
Ecosystem that's trying to be
it
normal.
It moves towards a path of regenerative health. And
yeah.
all you need to do is provide the right environment, i.e. Provide fertilization for the grass to grow, sunlight access to soil level,
yeah.
and time. And it will move in that direction. We don't need to go planting grass. It yeah. will do it. And we don't need to invent a carbon sequestration technology. We've got it.
Yeah.
The planet devised it millions of years ago.
Billions, probably.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So this is old. Just the same as low carbon keto is something that's been around for, over 100, 150 years.
Well,
right?
It's probably been around for since humans have been on the planet.
Since the beginning
right?
of the
yeah.
planet. But, we've been talking about it for a long time. So, it's basically about bringing back... restorative health, whether it's on a planetary basis or an individual, person basis. It's exciting stuff.
Awesome, Rob. Thank you so much.
No worries. You're welcome.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to the Flippin' Health Podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Precure. Prevention is cure. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. If you know someone who could benefit, please share it with them. Together, we can change medicine for the better. Change medicine for good.